Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is very special, Murray Carter, who is a master bladesmith and the owner of the Carter Cutlery in Oregon. And Murray spent 18 years in Japan, and he was trained under 16th generation bladesmith, and now he's a 17th generation Yoshimoto bladesmith. So today, Murray will share with you his unique experience in Japan and his deep insight into the culture of Japanese bladesmiths and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network, a website, as well as iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. So please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats and write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Murray Carter. Hi, Murray. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hello, Akiko. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm so pleased to have you. So first of all, where did you grow up?
So I was born and raised in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. I lived there until I was 18, at which time I took a trip to Japan, and my intention was to stay there for just 6 months, and instead I ended up staying for 18 years.
You never know.
That's right.
Right. So, were you interested in Japanese culture when you grew up?
Yeah, you know, I sure was. There was kind of an enigma, a mystique about the Orient, and growing up in Eastern Canada in the early 70s, where there was no internet and very limited information, you know, outside of the what you got on the TV, really. I was kind of fascinated because it was so unknown and kind of undiscovered, at least on my street it was.
Right. So the more you don't know, the more you want to discover. But that's how it goes.
That's right. Naimono nedari.
Yeah, that's a very good way to... That's a Japanese phrase. Yeah. Okay, so naimono means that something you don't have, and nedare means you really desire, crave for it, right? Okay, and so you just said you went to Japan at 18, so how did it happen?
Well, when I was 15 years old, I started the study of karate, and I progressed fairly rapidly through it because I was, you know, taking on double classes and very singularly focused on improving my technique and my understanding of the martial art. And, you know, with that, you know, I think some subconsciously comes a little bit of a, we'll say, for lack of better words, an indoctrination into the kind of the Japanese culture, the Japanese spirit, certainly outwardly the spirit of Bushido, or the warrior's spirit, kind of the honorable warrior spirit is emphasized and taught. So I did become interested in things of a Japanese nature outside of karate. And then probably what really sealed the deal was I watched a lot of TV as a child. I wasn't too much into sports outside of karate. And James Clavell's Shogun, and most people would know it, Shogun, the Shogun TV series about feudal Japan and about the Portuguese and the European sailors who found their way to Japan and how that story unveiled and the samurai and their kind of different their different ethics and different culture, different kind of martial discipline. Was very intriguing, and I think for me that really sealed the deal in terms of me being kind of singularly focused and interested in Japan as a culture and as a nation.
It's interesting because I think Bladesmith is very disciplinary in a way, and you're attracted to that aspect of Japanese culture, so there is still already a seed to get into.
For sure, looking back, it's kind of funny. I did Japanese taiko drums. Mm-hmm. And karate, I was part of the local hunting association in Japan, and I also was involved with the Honda racing motorcycle circuit. Mm. So all of these things have kind of the same thing in common, tremendous discipline and lots of responsibility and kind of a martial focus. It was very much different from the restaurant industry where that's convivial and cheerful and socializing and relaxing. Mm. In fact, it was always an uptight, disciplined environment.
Right. I think it's interesting because the word discipline is kind of the essence of Japanese culture because it's all about precision and never-ending pursuit of that precision and perfection.
And predictability. I think that's a big part of it, too, is Japanese society has a lot of, you got a lot of people in a small nation, and I think having been besieged by natural disasters, tsunami, volcanoes, typhoons, earthquakes, and everyone grows up with that, and everyone is always aware that in a heartbeat, everything they had or have can be lost to a natural disaster. Mm. I think it gives birth to this kind of this disciplined approach to life instead of a happy-go-lucky kind of whimsical, lackadaisical way of living life. And I think in that environment, predictability is also very important. And so I think there's a direct connection to all the natural disasters that Japan suffers through and their national spirit and character. And I think being disciplined and working hard and being predictable and being productive is a way of overcoming that. It's a strategy of life to overcome all of that adversity.
Mm, wow, that's a fascinating insight. I never knew, but that's so right. And that's interesting that, the tsunami, that really hit Japan. The last tsunami was really crazy. But I think there is, in the last century, 20th century, there is the first big earthquake caused a lot of fire because houses are wooden. So they built non-wood houses. And then all those shaking structure changed and improved. So actually, the last tsunami event, in Tokyo, there only a few people died from anything, like no collapsing buildings. So that's the result of that pursuit of precision and predictability.
That's right. That's right.
Right. So what did you do when you go to Japan at the age of 18?
Well, for your listeners, to give them a little understanding of my background, I was there to study karate, and one of the fellow karateka, means a colleague, in my dojo lent me his scooter to explore the town a little bit. It was actually a city of, I think, about 360,000 people, Kumamoto. And that's where your dad's from. Yeah, right. Well, you told me that earlier. We had a great conversation in Japanese earlier. It was
very impressive Japanese.
Yeah, it was fun. So I was exploring Kumamoto and looking for a bladesmith shop to find a teacher to teach me bladesmithing was arguably the last thing on my mind. Mm. But as I was driving by towards the end of my little 2-hour journey through town on this 50cc scooter, out of the corner of my eye, I saw this very impressive, kind of small, humble, but yet impressive in its own way, building. And there was this big display window with these beautiful knives in it, and large knives. The knives inside the display case, obviously for impact and for shock value, were Kujira Bocho. They were knives designed for the whaling industry.
Wow.
Large blades, obviously for taking apart whales. You know, they would be, in modern times, of course, that's not very common. So they would be used more for tuna and larger fish, bluefin tuna and so on. But anyway, I did a U-turn, pulled into the courtyard of that building and opened the door and met Sensei Yasuyuki Sakimoto, who was to take me under his wing for pretty much the better part of the next 18 years.
Mm.
And that was a total, you know, happenstance, by accident, by chance meeting.
So you just went to his store and say hi?
That's right. I literally said hi because I wasn't speaking Japanese. It was one of the first days after I had landed in Japan, and I wasn't speaking fluently like I do now.
Mm. So, but what was his reaction to have you, like, suddenly, you know, a little young foreign boy said hi, and he's interested, obviously, in his knives?
Well, you know, I should go back and ask him. I'm assuming I was probably the first non-Japanese person to step foot in that shop.
Mm.
So I'm sure there was an element of surprise. But, you know, you have to understand something about Mr. Sakimoto is he's very easygoing and he's very open-minded and he's very mellow. And, you know, in the ways in which I am very disciplined and gravitate towards things of a martial nature, he would be more comfortable in the restaurant industry. Not that there isn't discipline in the restaurant industry, but he's gregarious. He likes to relax. He likes to enjoy a good moment with a fellow companion. And so this was the perfect combination between kind of like my hard, rough, a bristly side and his very soft, accommodating, gentle side.
Mm.
And I think it was good chemistry from the beginning.
Well, the listeners, you can watch Mr. Sakimoto on the video at katakalori.com. But he used to be not seriously into bladesmith business, right? Because he had to succeed the family business. So
exactly. So he was the youngest of many children. And it was in a time and era. He grew up watching his uncle and his father be bladesmiths. And in fact, to paint a picture for your listeners, their property was like a gate which entered into an open courtyard, which then was the shop, which you would open up sliding glass doors and walk into the shop where there were knives. Then you would open up another glass door and walk into the back workshop area where the forge and the grinding stones were and all the polishing machines. And then you would go through another set of sliding glass doors, and then there was a little garden, and then behind that was the house. And the only way that, and behind the house was a wall. You couldn't get out that way. Mm. The Japanese say it's a unagi nedoko.
Unagi no nedoko.
Yeah.
Yeah, like long, long structure.
Yeah, it's a long strip of land. Mm-hmm. Like an eel. They call it like eel-style land use.
A bit of an eel.
So children born and raised in that house every day had to walk through both the workshop and the display room to get in and out of their own house to go to school. So even if you weren't interested in bladesmithing, you know, you would wake up in the morning and go to school and you'd say goodbye to your uncle, your dad, who were forging knives. You know, you'd literally be dodging through sparks, you know, as you were going to school because it was such a very tiny, tiny space. So, you know, when it came to be somebody's turn, when his father passed away, the 15th generation Yoshimoto bladesmith, when it was somebody's turn to do that, the other brothers and sisters didn't want having to do with it.
Mm.
This was the 60s when no one wanted a, what they call in Japanese, sanke shigoto. It means the three Ks, kitanai, kitsui, kiken, meaning it's dirty work, it's dangerous work, and it's tiring work.
Mm.
And I often make a joke and say it's yonke shigoto because the fourth K is kuryo ga yasui, meaning not very well paying work either.
Right.
So, you know, everyone at that era wanted the job at Mitsubishi or at Honda or Toyota or, you know, one of these giant companies where you would have lifelong employment and it was, you know, not hard labor. It was prestigious, you know, it was white collar work. So to when all of your friends in high school are going off to do all of these prestigious jobs and you would have to say, oh, I'm gonna go back into bladesmithing like my father and uncle did before me, and I'm gonna get my hands dirty every day, and probably, you know, next time I see you, I'll have burns all over my arms, and et cetera, et cetera. It just wasn't a fashionable thing to do. It wasn't the choice that most youngsters were making in those days. So none of his brothers or sisters wanted anything to do with it. When he realized, like, he was the youngest, and no one of his brothers and sisters wanted to do it, he felt a tremendous kind of sense of as he says in his video, you know, mutainai, what a waste, what a shame it would be to let 15 generations of bladesmithing just die out. Mm. And so he kind of, in a way, begrudgingly, because he didn't want to get involved, you know, he didn't want to have to roll his sleeves up and get involved up to his eyebrows in the actual forging and making of knives and sharpening of knives. So he didn't really want to do it, but he did make a conscious choice. He said, you know, Would I rather go and take a job at Mitsubishi or something, or would I rather see this family heritage continue on? And he made a conscious choice to say, you know what, I really want to preserve the family legacy. So he did willingly become the 16th generation Yoshimoto bladesmith.
Right, and then probably he knew how hard to find the next generation as well. And then here you go, you have a very ambitious non-Japanese person knocking on the door. So maybe that's the reason but you cannot just say hi and then can I work for you? Then it didn't happen like that, right?
No, we sat down and had tea that first time, and I think we established a good rapport, even though we were relying more on his understanding of English than we were relying on my comprehension of Japanese at the time. But we established a good rapport, and then we met a couple of times after that, because I basically asked if I could just come and visit the shop sometime and, like, watch him sharpen knives or watch, you know, him forge steel or whatnot. And he said, you know, he said, anytime, you can swing by anytime. It wasn't until I had been to an intensive year at the University of British Columbia subsequently after that experience. So I was in Japan for 9 months the first trip. And I met him like those first few days, saw him a couple of times during those 9 months, but then went back to Canada for an intensive, basically 4 years of Japanese reading and writing study in one academic calendar year. and then that whole time I was thinking, I'm going to go back and I'm going to see Mr. Sakimoto again. And I think this time I can actually get in the forge and actually learn something. Mm. And I'll have the language ability to do it. And so it was when I went back that second stint in Japan, I immediately, probably within the first second or 2 days, kind of said, Tadaima, you know, I'm back. And he was surprised because, you know, in Japan, especially in the early 80s, you had a lot of foreigners, you know, gaikokujin, coming from, you know, all sorts of European and Australia and Canadian, you know, North American countries, but almost always for a short-term visit and almost never to come back again. Mm. There's kind of an understanding in those days when if you met like an exchange student, you said hi, and then it was time for them to go, and you said goodbye, you almost never expected to see them again.
Right, just only transient. And
just kind of transient. And so for me to come back and now to be speaking very, not quite fluent, but very good Japanese, I think it was the moment where he said, oh, this guy, this is different. And I can expect something different. And, you know, I wonder what's in store next.
Right. So that's when you started as a bladesmith.
That's when I got in the forge and forged my first blade. It was after I'd come back from that year at college. And you know, honestly, once I forged my first blade, I mean, it was ugly as sin and wasn't good for anything. Forged up in a strange shape and I didn't know how to get it back in line again. But having hammered hot steel and had this blazing hot 3,400 degrees Celsius fire at my fingertips, and to feel the glow on my face, and to feel the hot steel, you know, giving off heat, I was hooked.
Right. So you went back and say had and tadaima in Japanese. So from that, you know, you just started to go to the place every day and worked full time as a apprentice.
As many people who have been to Japan for a year or so can relate, I had to teach English in order to support myself there.
Mm.
And so I kind of had my own little English conversation school. But the blessing there was that the work hours were pretty much late afternoon until 9 or 10 o'clock at night, giving me every morning free, you know, morning till lunch, morning till 1 or 2 for free. And often, more often than not, I would just go straight to the bladesmith shop and either start or continue working on a project. Of course, the first few knives I made took over, you know, upwards of 50 hours to complete. So
wow.
That's a lot of mornings going and just working on the same piece of metal and wood.
Right. And I don't know how many bladesmiths exist. I think its number is declining. But was there any specific philosophy by Mr. Sakimoto?
Yeah, I think the first and most important, thinking about it, it clearly was the most important thing that Mr. or Sensei Sakimoto taught me was how to get a truly sharp edge on a blade.
Mm.
Because if you think about it, no matter how elaborate a knife is, everything in the knife is there just to support what I call the primary edge.
Mm.
The blade is there to support the cutting edge. And the handle is there to be able to support the blade and to be able to transfer the power and control from the forearm and the hand all the way down to the cutting edge of the blade. So understanding, you know, what it takes and what makes for a what we call a scary sharp edge kind of gives you the blueprint for the rest of the knife design.
Wow, it sounds like you're creating extension of your hand in a way, not just the tool. Right. Okay. And, well, obviously you kind of survived that disciplinary training, but what do you think is most important as bladesmith to, you know, personality or skills or talent?
Yeah, we like to joke and laugh in the industry saying that bladesmiths are born, they're not made. And I have students now currently who travel all over the world to come and take classes with us in Oregon. And one of the very kind of concrete lessons that we leave them with after either a few days or a week with us is for them to make knives in batches of 10. So they'll forge 10 blades, they'll grind and heat treat 10 blades, and then straighten and grind and polish those blades into finished working blades, and then they'll spend, you know, many days constructing and shaping and finishing the handles for those knives. And the idea is that after they finish a batch of 10 knives, they go and make their next batch of 10 knives. And kind of one of two or three things is going to happen. They're either not going to want to forge the next batch of 10 knives. They'll have had enough. Like, okay, been there, done that. That's off my bucket list. Made 10 knives, give them to some friends. Now I know what it's all about. But really, you know, I want to go race motor cars, or I want to do paragliding or something like that. You know, for the bucket list type of person. The other thing that's going to happen is, conversely, is the person's just going to be just dying to go forge, start their next batch of 10 knives.
Wow.
And that's a good indicator. If after making and completing 10 knives, they're just dying to make 10 more knives, then they probably have the essentials of being a bladesmith. After they forge their next batch of 10 knives is when it really becomes telling, though. This is where you start to separate the chaff from the wheat, so to speak. If they forge and complete another batch of 10 knives, but there's no significant improvement in the overall fit, finish, and symmetry and design of the knives, that's a warning sign. That means that they have the gumption and the attitude, the right attitude to be a bladesmith, but they may or may not have the right aptitude. So first test is, do they get in there and make batch after batch after batch after batch of knives and still love it?
Mm.
You know, that means sparks in the eyes, grinding their fingernails till they bleed, or not their fingernails, their fingertips till they bleed. you know, hand sanding wooden handles until their forearms ache and yet come back for the next batch.
Mm.
If, though, we don't see significant improvement from batch to batch to batch, then they you know, I encourage them to keep at it, but it might be an eye-opener that maybe that's not their life's calling.
Mm.
Because finishing 10 knives and then making another 10 knives is such a Herculean task. I mean, it's akin to, I mean, this is a loose analogy, but if you finish 10 and then 20 knives and you see no improvement, it's kind of like going through a PhD program at college, but not really fully comprehending your material by the time you finish the research. Mm. I mean, maybe it wasn't really your cup of tea.
Right, yeah. Well, before, so we're talking about, you know, the bladesmith is not muscle power, but the brain power. Yeah, maybe you can share that thought with the listeners.
Well, that's right. Akiko and you and I met just a few moments ago for the first time, and we were chatting in Japanese, you looked, oh, it must take so much, you know, muscle power to forge all those knives. And you said, do you think I could do it? I said, yes, I think you could do it, because I'm always telling my apprentices that the knife, you know, bladesmithing and being a knife maker is a thinking person's game. You always have to be able to anticipate two or three steps beyond where you're at when you're bladesmithing. It's not unlike being a race car driver, where, you know, more than just the actual skills of driving and the hand-eye coordination and knowing how to brake into a corner, you know, racing a car is much about anticipating the corner before you get to it, and anticipating the straightaway before you get to it, and knowing what to do mentally before you just kind of start relying on reflexes. If you're a race car driver and you're driving on reflexes alone, and you don't have situational awareness, you're probably not the kind of race car driver who's going to be winning races.
Right. So you mean that, you know, how the temperature is going to change as this timing and when you hit the, you know.
Yeah, it's for example, it's before you even place the metal to be forged in the fire. You're taking very careful notes of the dimensions of the steel, and you're already in your head rehearsing where the hammer blows are going to fall.
Mm.
And then once you put it in the steel, it's tending the fire in such a way that you're going to heat up the thickest part of the blade first and not the thinnest part and risk an overheat, which ruins the grain of the steel. And once you get your fire and everything all figured out, it's then glancing over to the power hammer and saying, is my brush to clean the steel there? Or do I have the right tongs? You know, is the power hammer oiled? Is the switch on? You know, is the surface of my anvil cleaned off? Do I have my handheld hammer there? It's always trying to stay one step ahead, because when you pull the steel out of the fire, it's cliche, but you have to strike while the iron's hot. You only have so much heat in a thin kitchen knife to work with, and you've got to make the most efficient use of that heat and of that time so that you can hammer in a logical way that not only results in getting closer to the final shape you want, but more importantly, and often overlooked, is you hammer the steel in a way to refine the grain of the steel. You're actually improving this raw material that you start off with by very careful mental planning.
Mm. And also, especially Japanese knives are layered, not with just one material, like two or three different materials, right?
That's right.
You have to, depending on what kind of knife, you have to really think. So full of attention. Right. Okay, maybe I'll think about trying. I have to train my brain first. So, you know, at the end of your training for 6 years, so you were asked to become the 17th generation of Yoshimoto bladesmith. But how did you prove that you're there, you're ready?
It's not like I keep a day-to-day journal, so it's difficult to look back and give you an accurate chronological history of how that unfolded. But here we are, you know, 30 years into that whole adventure. And as I look back and think back, the way I remember it currently is that towards the end of that 6 years, maybe in the end of the fourth year and the fifth year, there kind of was, I felt, as I remember it now, this understanding that that was the way things were going to go. You know, it's not like there was eight other students and we were all competing against each other and it was tense because nobody knew who was going to edge out the other person, pardon the pun. In this case, it was just me and Mr. Sakamoto and my burning passion to learn everything I could about bladesmithing and his unfaltering support of that and this beautiful chemistry between, you know, young Caucasian, in many ways, abrasive, prickly personality and his very accommodating and understanding personality. And so we became kind of a team in an odd way. And I think that I knew that's where things were headed around the fifth year. What I did do, though, that is very specific, that's easier for listeners to comprehend, is I did tackle a bladesmithing project many steps beyond, out of my comfort level, to kind of prove to myself and to him that I had a very kind of comprehensive understanding of the process. As I took this Hitachi white steel and blue steel and this Gokunan Tetsu mild steel that's smelted specifically for cutlery, and I made a very, very complex layered billet of what we're commonly refer to as Damascus steel. And it was a soft core on the inside with a hard kawa hagane, which is a term borrowed from the katana bladesmithing industry. And I made this very elaborate, jacketed, laminated blade in the style of a tanto or a short sword. So I used modern materials, I used traditional techniques, and I made what some would consider a traditional samurai sword, short sword, but using kind of cleaner, higher carbon steel. It wouldn't be recognized by an authentic katana kajiya or Japanese sword smith as being authentic because I wasn't using tamahagane, which is the bloom steel that most swordsmiths start off with. But certainly in terms of complexity and authenticity in the construction and the water quenching and so on that I did, it was very authentic. So I kind of proved that I had swordsmithing skills, which are many levels higher than required for just being an agricultural bladesmith,
right.
which is what we were. We were no kaji, which is meaning agricultural bladesmith. Japan, you have katana kaji, which is kind of considered to be the highest tip of the echelon of bladesmithing.
The samurai sword.
Samurai swords, right. Yeah. Then next down from that, well, then you're either in Japan, you're either katana kaji, which is swordsmith, or you're no kajiya, which is kind of agricultural bladesmiths. But within agricultural bladesmiths, which is all others, if you're the bladesmith who makes the temple tools for miyadaiku,
okay,
who are the carpenters who make the temples and the shrines, if you're making like plain blades and chisels just for those carpenters, you're considered, you know, high-end bladesmith. And then if you're, you know, making things like marine tools or forestry tools, it's kind of considered one rank below that. But within that ranking, you can be the best in one area and be better than the lowest in the highest. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So so that's kind of how the Japanese view that superficially. And so by demonstrating that I had a good understanding of swordsmithing skills, I think there was a very concrete way of demonstrating my ability.
So in my opinion, I think you also advanced the tradition. I think that's what's required for any tradition, because you get stuck. I keep doing the same thing over and over. You don't evolve, and tradition is going to die eventually. So I think you're such an asset for Japanese sword making. and Burmese tradition. Mm. So,
yeah, I think there's a common understanding that the apprentice becomes a journeyman in their trade, and the day that they innovate and can create something beyond even their own teacher's skill set or imagination is kind of when they become the master, and often then, you know, either carry on the tradition or they branch out on their own.
Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about marriage and knives, and he produces in Oregon, so please stay with us.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit rt11.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcasting Live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Mary Carter, who is a 17th generation master bladesmith and the owner of the Carter Cutlery in Oregon. So let's talk about your business in Oregon. So so you decided to open your place in Oregon, not in Canada, not in Japan. So maybe you can quickly tell us what it is for.
Oh, what's so special about Oregon? Yeah. Well, Oregon, well, first of all, it's on the West Coast, and I was pretty sure, having gone to college at University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, that even though I was born and raised on the East Coast, I knew I wanted to live on the West Coast. Mm. I like the change of topography and all the geological features. You got the ocean, you've got mountains, you've got glaciers, you've got rainforests, very lush, and so I like the West Coast. The decision was, do I go back to Canada or do I try to become a U.S. citizen? Because as a Canadian, I couldn't just show up on U.S. soil and just decide I was going to live here. It was going to involve a lengthy, you know, immigration process. So I kind of felt that, United States was center stage for the cutlery industry. I'd been traveling from Japan to various trade shows all over the United States and to France, to a couple of different places annually as well. But it just, the newest knives and, the greatest customer base and the greatest interest and the biggest and most impressive kind of trend-setting factories and companies were all here in the United States. Mm. So,
But you didn't decide to stay in Japan, right? So what's the reason for that?
Well, I'd been in Japan for 18 years, and I felt there was kind of four concrete reasons at the time that I decided to move from Japan to the United States, or at least to North America. The biggest reason was I had four children who were all born and raised in Japan, and I wanted them to have an international education. I wanted them to be exposed to the kind of Judeo-Christian culture and education to round out and complement their Japanese language and their Japanese education. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, I was pretty sure that I wanted to further my education. And at the time, I was trying to do some adult studies at university. And although I'd been to university in Canada, I didn't graduate with a degree. I'd just taken a handful of different classes that I thought I could benefit from. So I didn't actually have a degree in hand. And so that's not a possibility in Japan, to go to Japan,
right,
to go to college as an adult for continuing education. And thirdly, I felt like, even though I was practicing traditional Japanese bladesmithing, and I had inquired at the local town office about, you know, what it took to be recognized as a traditional artisan or a traditional craftsman, as they say in Japanese, like dento kogehi or dento kogeka, and it was pretty much as a non-native Japanese person. It looked like the hurdles to get that recognition were pretty much insurmountable.
That's very frustrating.
you know, I love Japan, and I've had a relationship with Japan for 30 years, and my children are all born there, and that's their first language, and I speak the language fluently, and I love going back, and I feel like I've got family there. But there are just a few, you know, traditional things that are tough to stomach, such as if you're not a native-born Japanese person, you cannot be part of their volunteer fire department. Mm. I mean, it's just, it's a stipulation that's been there forever. And even in this year, 2017, there's still kind of that insular nation, you know, Shimaguni Konjo.
Right.
There's a little bit of, you know, nationalism, subliminal. And unless you live there for a long time, you won't feel it. But
right. Well, that's the stubbornness that preserves the, you know, the tradition really well. But the other side of the coin is that's very inflexible.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Close-minded in a way. So,
well, like you said, you almost can't have one with the other. You can't have, you know, the martial discipline of taiko drums and bladesmithing and karate if you let it just become diluted by the international mindset. So, you know, what makes the things, I mean, you know, whether it's sumo to sushi to kimonos, you know, what makes that so interesting, or ikebana, or for example, what makes it so fascinating for the rest of the world is because it is uniquely Japanese. And what keeps it uniquely Japanese is by keeping it purely Japanese. So if you're just willing, if a culture is willing to dilute any of its customs and traditions and language and culture and rules, you no longer have that unique perspective. So you really can't have one without the other.
But, you know, I think by having you outside of Japan gives, you know, the global audience to learn more about bladesmith, traditional Japanese bladesmith. And also I think that you mixed the sword technique and the blazing technique together, I think your creation becomes even more interesting, maybe. So I think overall, that's the benefit to the blazing industry.
It's worked out amazingly well. And so I did move to North America thinking that I might get more public recognition for my work here on center stage than in Japan. And just like you're saying, interestingly, just the reverse happened is by moving out of Japan and promoting Japanese bladesmithing here in North America, where I have literally an international audience and students who come from all over the world to study with us at Carter Cutlery for anywhere between a day and 15-day intensive classes. You know, we've gained a lot of traction. One very interesting result is we started doing custom-made handles for some of our traditional Japanese-shaped kitchen knives. Of course, we specialize in really thin, high-performance, really, really sharp, scary sharp cutting kitchen knives. But the traditional handles in Japan, typically made of a honoki, magnolia wood, with like a water buffalo horn ferrule. So it's kind of like a blondish tan wooden handle with a black bolster or ferrule in just between the blade and the handle. That is kind of so plain Jane that we started doing custom handles, and we started taking like ironwood and Osage orange and cocobolo and stabilized maple wood, and we started making these really interesting, beautiful, kind of organically feeling octagonal handles for our Japanese-style kitchen knives, and then even sometimes incorporating synthetic materials like G10 and micarta and different types of corian and so on. We started making custom handles for our Japanese knives, and it caught on so well that now Japanese knife makers are getting custom handles made for their knives. It's almost, if you want to export a Japanese knife to North America now, it's got to have one of these custom handles on. So I've influenced all of the Japanese bladesmithing industry, and the only way that would have ever happened is was by stepping out of it.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Do you know how many bladesmiths are left in Japan? I heard it's really declining, numbers declining.
Yeah, again, for that 3K or 3K reason, you know, it is tough, it's hard, it's usually not well compensated and dangerous, and it's hard to attract young folks to bladesmithing in Japan. But I was very fortunate that the Nippon Hoso Kyoku, the NHK, did a couple of documentaries on
two biggest TV stations in Japan.
Yeah, and then TBS and Tokoro George did a program about me doing bladesmithing.
Mm.
And now we see a resurgence of young people in Japan who are approaching older bladesmiths and saying, please teach me your craft.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. So the Japanese bladesmith industry really got lucky to have you.
You know, I don't like to toot my own horn, but it's just very, very fortunate it turned out that way.
Right. This little scooter, 50cc scooter trip to in Kumamoto changed the whole industry.
That's right.
Right. So, how are you planning to train 18th generation of Yoshimoto? Because talking about all those things, succession and planning, and you're in Oregon, so what's your prospect?
Well, first of all, you know, it's a really awesome and sobering responsibility to know that I represent 430 years of continued Japanese traditional bladesmithing heritage, and I'm 17th generation, which implies there should be, if possible, an 18th generation bladesmith. So, you know, day to day, as I'm making knives, forging knives, conducting my business, traveling to New York for podcasts, for example, whatever it is, it's always uppermost in my mind that I need to pave the way for the 18th generation person, and so I did set up a program in Oregon where our shop is. It's an apprenticeship program, which basically allows pretty much anybody who thinks they might be interested in bladesmithing to go through a three-month apprentice program.
Mm.
And I call it the Navy SEALs training of the bladesmithing world, because it's very strict and very unforgiving. And people who think they want to be a bladesmith who don't have the right aptitude or attitude get weeded out very quickly.
Mm.
But I have a program where people can try their hand at bladesmithing, and currently we have three bladesmiths who work full-time at Carter Cutlery who are graduates of the program, so they are journeyman smiths. One of the gentlemen is our senior journeyman smith, and currently we have a fourth in training. And, one day I hope that hundreds of people, but, you know, one day in the future, I hope that hundreds of people will have gone through that training. Some will stay working for Carter Cutlery. Some will go on to open up their own bladesmith shops and continue in the tradition. But the idea is to find the 18th generation bladesmith through that program, that they will come into it and they will just immediately identify themselves by their attitude and their aptitude as being the perfect next Murray Carter to come along to take the whole Yoshimoto bladesmithing family history to the next level.
Right, amazing. So good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, so, thank you for joining us today, Murray.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Akiko.
And please come back, and then we have so much more to talk about.
Yes, indeed.
Right. So listeners, if you'd like to know more about the Murray's knives and want to train as a potential apprentice, please go to katakatori.com. That's one word, katakatori.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatayama.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher as a podcast. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. Thank you so much. And today's show was by engineer is Vitor Harsh. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. and we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.